This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 431 on my way to 2000. There's a bit of sadness today. A little bit of sadness. I left my notes at home. I obviously do have my recorder, but I left my notes at home, so we're just going to be winging it. So the disclaimer right from the start is that some of the facts that I'm going to be relating, or at least some of the information that I'm going to be relating, may not be entirely accurate. At the very least, I was going to try to quote from the documentary correctly, but given that my notes are at home, sitting on top of the printer, and they didn't make it into my little case that has the digital recorder in it, I'm just gonna wing this. So, aside from that, work is well. We actually completed our first beta test of our new paperless form this month. We got the information transferred. The information was built automatically. It appears to have been built correctly to do all the transfers that need to be done. We were able to hop up and over and transfer that stuff on command without it having to be entered. Yay. So that's all good. We have some changes that need to be made in the next few weeks. That's all doable. We'll run another test in July. If that goes well, we will start expanding. Anyways, so that's all good. And it means that we have done real work with the tool, and the tool performed admirably. We didn't have any huge problems with the tool. And so, yay, that's good too. As far as writing goes, this obviously is the last week in June, which means that this is the week that I'm supposed to have finished the production version of Windfall 6, which is Windfall Wheat and Tares. I should have a copy of the production version coming in tomorrow as a proof copy. I've been working on the Kindle version, and I have it completed. Hopefully finishing up the EPUB version tonight. If I get that done, then come tomorrow, I can hop across and I can start working on getting back to Windfall 7. I have a couple of tasks before I can do that. One of them is entering all the facts in the fact database that I try to keep. That really hasn't been that much use to me yet, because I never seem to have the fact that I need. And so I have to just go back and read back down through the books and try to remember where I said that before. Although it has helped me a couple of times, so. The other thing that I need to do is I need to prepare the summary. After I got three or four books into this, I realized that the way I was trying to do the last time on such and such was really not working. So I ended up stopping trying to add verbosely to the characters and terminology introduction and simply ended up doing a timeline where each book would take half a page. And so I have to summarize each book in half a page, which is a little bit interesting, but I've been able to get it done so far. I don't know how good the summaries are, but as long as they attain to the level of passable mediocrity, we're just fine. So I have to do that for book 6 now that the production version is done. Then once I get those little tasks done, then I'm back to starting to read through what I've done so far on book 7 and trying to figure out how in the world this book ends. I am halfway through book 7. I'm around 82, 1,000 words on it, and I'm going to somewhere around 140, hopefully. So it'll be interesting to see how this all works out. Anyway, so there's that. My mom is still in long-term care. There have been a few little health complications along the way, but we're puttering forward. Tomorrow we start going through division of assets so that we can protect at least a little money for my dad. Step at a time. Step at a time. So, but anyways, we are, I came across, well, before I start there, let me back up a minute. I am always fascinated and a bit chagrined and amused at people when a disaster happens, when some enemy finds an advantage. I'm always intrigued and chagrined and a bit amused when people then immediately attempt to lay the blame for it on God. Why did God let this happen? How can a loving God allow such suffering in the world? You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because I've lived for long enough that I've learned that if you just wait, you find out some really intriguing things about situations that happen on a national scale. And if it doesn't happen on a national scale, and it's only a personal scale, and if you would do some research, I am convinced that you would also find out many intriguing things, even if it was just on a personal scale, that might answer your questions about where was God, why does God let people suffer, why doesn't a good God allow evil in the world? That particular question of why doesn't God do something about the evil in the world causes me the most chagrin and probably the most amusement. Because everyone who asks that question has decided that whatever evil exists in the world obviously does not exist in them. And so they are quite content for God to eliminate that evil in the world because they are quite confident that, in fact, they will not be eliminated. Which I'm not sure that any of us are capable of making that discernment. It comes back to that parable that gives me the shakes, the counting house. That we are so certain there are those who owe much greater than we owe, and we are well within our rights to point fingers and to make pronouncements and bring condemnation. So, having said all that as an introduction, which we will get back to, came across a documentary this week as I was working on all these files. And looking through, you know, I just needed kind of something to run in the background. And I saw this documentary, and I had some exposure to some of the facts around 9/11. In fact, I had a chapter that I had written after reading portions of the 9/11 Commission's report. And I put a chapter in Still Whispers, the book that I wrote when I turned 50. 8 years ago. So I had some exposure, and I had heard some of the terms that were in this documentary, and so I almost didn't watch the documentary. It was not prime. I was going to have to pay for it, but I sort of ran out of things that interested me, and so I thought, why not? Let's give it a try. Paid my $3.99 to stream it in standard definition and started it up. And it was very interesting. It gave a lot of background on the important players in the documentary. There's four or five key players in here, and they are people who either worked with the NSA for years or had had some hand in funding for the NSA. One of them was a woman who worked in Congress and who oversaw the requests that NSA had put in for funding. The rest of them were individuals who I think they all worked in, or most of them worked in, a small little working group called SARC, I think. I'm doing this all from memory. That was SIGINT, Signals Intelligence Active Research Group or something, or Active Research something, Committee. Anyways, these guys had a fairly novel approach to things. And one guy in particular had had a great deal of success in terms of signal intelligence and getting actionable data out of paying attention to communications. You know, he had worked with mapping, I think it was the Russian forces and the command and control structure. He had also worked in Vietnam with the Vietnamese communications. And he, in fact, I think it was 2 months before, based on what he was observing, had predicted that the Tet Offensive was about to occur. Obviously, he didn't know what it was called, but that there would be an offensive, a quote-unquote surprise offensive. All those briefings had gone out. Barely any of the officers in the military reacted to it. He had said in the documentary that there was one military officer who had taken it seriously and had his men, at least 50% of his men, in the trenches they had dug out all the time. And when the offensive actually did start, the first day he was able to turn back the offensive and only lose one man. Unfortunately, the officers on either side of his flank had not had as much confidence in the intelligence, had not prepared, and when they fell, then he eventually had to draw back. And so this man who was working in this SARC group, very intelligent, very capable when it came to signals intelligence, had seen what happened when people ignored actionable intelligence. And he had come up with this idea of using metadata, that is, the data about things like phone calls, the idea of using metadata to gain actionable intelligence. With the rise of cell phones, and with their locations, and with their logs that show who is calling whom, and with that all being available to NSA, he imagined and worked with programmers and diagrammed out and proposed the ability to establish connections based on the metadata, not based on the actual conversations, but simply based on the metadata, that would screen through, make connections, send the data back, so that then a bigger picture could be made of who is calling whom, where are they, what is the frequency of the calls, what's the duration of the calls, to try to map and track and see what was there. They had been working quietly in the NSA in the 1990s to develop this. They eventually came up with some sequencing software, and they talked to a unit in Germany and sent it to them just to get an opinion. And the unit in Germany took a look at it and they said, wow, this is really cool. Why don't we just go ahead and slap this on all of our incoming information and just see what it'll do? So they slapped it on Friday as they were walking out the door. And by Saturday morning, there were alarm bells going off at the NSA because it was sending back so much intelligence that it was threatening to bring the NSA systems to its knees. So they brought in someone to shut it down on the weekend. And what that illustrated for those involved is that the NSA was woefully behind the times, because at this point in the 90s, the NSA was still doing keyword searches and they just didn't have the capacity to monitor the burgeoning digital communications that were being caused not only by cell phones, but by the eruption of the internet with email. And it was generally agreed that a lot of the communication, well, it was generally agreed by some that a lot of the communication the terrorist networks were using were in fact being broadcast over the internet. There were some who couldn't believe that because they said it's all open, it's not secure. Why in the world would anybody do that? But of course it gets buried in the deluge of information. So, as part of all of that, then this sequencing and this ability that these guys had developed to establish connections between things, they started developing something called ThinThread. And it was this idea that we are going to monitor the data and establish the relationships between telephones and email addresses and who's mailing who and how often are they doing it and what's the size of the, without actually looking at the content, because it was these guys' contention that you could find a tremendous amount of information out just by looking at this, quote, metadata. About this same time, there is a new head that's brought into the NSA, and he makes great pronouncements about how the NSA, I'm backing into my garage, is going deaf and blind, and how that something needs to be done about it. And of course, this is all kind of during the time that the USS Cole is bombed in the Persian Gulf, and the trade towers are, the first attempt is made on the trade towers, where the bomb goes off in the basement and doesn't bring down the towers, but kills some people and injures others, etc., etc., etc. And so there is this impetus, there is this understanding that, yes, you know, the terrorist threat is rising and we need to do something about it, etc., etc., etc. So in the process of all of that, word starts getting out about ThinThread and about what it can do. And so this new head sends down one of his deputies, and these guys have been toiling in obscurity, spending, you know, a million here, a million there, and a guy comes down and he asks them, what could you do with $1.2 billion? Whoa, they said, give us a couple of days. So they go through, they run all their best guess, guy comes down, and he says, you know, honestly, we could revamp everything, get us all the capacity we needed for about $300,000. We don't really need the 1.2. Oh, that's great. That's great. So he goes back and he comes back a short time later. And he says, well, what could you guys, you did such a great job with that. You know, what could you guys do with $1.4 billion? And, you know, they're just kind of looking at the guy like, So they said, you know, they try to answer again. And one moment. That's my daughter texting me, but I'll call her back in just a minute. So then what it comes down to is, short time later, there is this announcement from the head of the NSA that, in fact, they have this new initiative. And I can threshold Something. Anyways, this new initiative, they're going to, and it's going to cost billions of dollars, and they're going to modernize, and they're going to start with their analog systems, and they're going to build out from there. And like the congressional person who is looking at approving things, she's saying, but you've got FinThread over there, and why are you not, looking at enhancing that as because it's working. At the same time, these guys are looking at FinThread, who are developing FinThread, and they're saying, this could just monitor everybody. They've got the capacity now, it's working. And these guys are really concerned about the fact that this is invading US citizens' privacy. So they build in this whole encryption layer so that you have to have a warrant before you can reveal who people are. And they're doing all this stuff, trying to work within the law. Yada, yada, yada. Well, this other big project that's going to cost billions of dollars, according to these guys, needed to take prominence, and they started getting edicts down that, this is the big project that the NSA has decided it's doing, and you don't need to be rocking the boat trying to prove that there's another way. You just need to get with the plan, and you need to be a company person, and blah, 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 blah. And so this keeps going on through the late 90s, up into the 2000s. By August of 2001, the tension has gotten big enough that word comes down from the top. We're discontinuing FinThread. We're going to pull all your funding. They go up, they talk to one of the deputies about it. She gives them a speech about, well, basically, I could either make six people unhappy, which is you six, or I can make 500 people unhappy, and I've decided to make you six unhappy, so we're discontinuing FinThread. So they discontinue it. 3 weeks later, the planes hit the trade towers. Of course, there's a lot of soul searching afterwards, and the documentary goes on to the after effects and all that kind of thing. And there's some really sad stuff, but I'm home and I got to call my daughter, so I'm going to wrap this up. But there comes a point where FinThread gets resurrected without the knowledge of the guys who designed it, because they're just using the supporting stuff underneath, and all the encryption gets ripped out. So they start monitoring everybody at the NSA. And once these guys who built FinThread, which is just like a month later when this starts happening, find out about it, they just decide that's it, we're out of here. Because it is in their minds unconscionable that all the safeties have been pulled off this thing, and now it's just been turned loose on the United States and the world. And so they resign, and they have a long and convoluted story of trying to take these same ideas to other government agencies because they feel like they could be abused, and the NSA is blocking them at every turn and telling the people who are even looking at them, this is going to embarrass the head of the NSA, so you need to stop doing this. And so there's just, I mean, everything just closes up on them. And at one point, for some reason, they get access to all of the data that was had, in those last 3 weeks. And they did run the FinThread system on it, according to them, as part of an experiment by the NSA. And the thing ran for 24 to 36 hours. And after it ran, they said everything was there. They said it exposed all of the intelligence that we needed to stop the 9/11 attacks. And in fact, exposed that there were several other planes that were going to be hijacked, that the plans were in place to hijack them, but for one reason or another, did not get hijacked. And all of the intelligence was sitting there, that this thing had exposed using connections between people as it tracked them and where they were and how long the conversations were, et cetera, et cetera. So what this all comes down to, for me, is when people say, well, why didn't God prevent this tragedy? Well, why does God allow good people to suffer? Well, why does God this? Why does God that? What it comes down to for me is free will. God has built this world. He's given us dominion over this world. He's given us free will. And that free will is more important to him than our personal suffering. Because he has given us autonomy. And he has allowed us to create whatever world we wish to create with our abilities. Now, that doesn't mean for me that he has stepped away and completely taken his hands off. Because I do think that he is speaking to all of us all the time. And I do think that all the ideas that this signals intelligence guy had all those years were Jesus whispering to him. You know, you could try this, you could try that, you could try this, you could try that. It's a partnership. So people say, why didn't God do something about it? My response is God did do something about it. He gave a lot of people a lot of really good ideas that would have been successful, that would have stopped 9/11 from happening. And the reason it didn't is because people in leadership were more concerned about getting as much money as they could from the government, and even after 9/11 happened, were more concerned about how do we build our own little kingdom. Because there are a couple of places where these guys are quoted as saying, one guy in particular said that he was going around with this deputy who had killed the Thin Thread Project the day after 9/11. And she was saying, her take on it was, this is going to be great for the NSA because we're going to get all the money we want and more. And that's what she was telling people. This is going to be great, because they were demoralized about the fact they had had an intelligence failure. No, no, no. You have to understand, this is going to be really good for the NSA. So be encouraged. And the guy said, you know, it was just sickening to see that all they cared about was building the organization and not really protecting Americans. So you see, Jesus whispers. Jesus gives us ideas. But he also honors free will. So the next time you hear someone talking about why didn't God step in and intervene, why does God allow suffering in the world, but the answer to all of that is free will. And I will guarantee you that no matter what the disaster, no matter what the sorrow and the horror, if you will just wait while people dig underneath it, or if you spend enough time digging it underneath it yourself, you will eventually find that there was a way to prevent it if people had listened more, paid more attention, instead of being dedicated solely to their own self-aggrandizement and self-promotion and self-sustainment. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.